You are tuned to WBAI in New York and the Pacifica Radio Network. My name is Robert Knight, and we broadcast live at 99.5 megahertz FM and stream at the website WBAI.org. And we continue our live post-mortem of the presidential beauty contest tonight, the so-called town hall debate, brought to us by the Presidential Debate Commission between two of the various parties running for the presidency of the United States, tonight featuring President Barack Obama and Republican challenger, former Governor Mitt Romney. In tonight's continuing coverage, we will take a close look at the arrest just a short time ago of the Green Party presidential and vice presidential nominees Jill Stein and Sherry Honkala. That happened at the Hofstra University venue of tonight's town hall meeting. It did not become a prominent part of the debate, but it will be a prominent part of our coverage tonight. We will also be speaking with Medea Benjamin, a feminist and a returnee from Pakistan and other places in protest of the ongoing drone strikes by the United States around the world. And we will also be hearing from George Farah, who has been a constant critic of the containment of debates and presidential politics and discussion by way of the bipartisan conspiracy known as the so-called Presidential Debates Commission. We begin tonight's continuing coverage with a very special guest, Summer Reese, the new executive director of our parent institution, the Pacifica Foundation, at work for peace, justice, and enlightenment for more than 60 years. And Summer, welcome at this serendipitous moment to the studios of WBAI.
Thank you, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you have inherited the wind. You have
yes.
You have become the executive director of the most progressive national institution of radio, of non-commercial, of listener-sponsored radio, with its five owned and operated stations in Washington, Houston, New York, Berkeley, and Los Angeles. And you come at a very Harry Seldon kind of time, a moment of crisis. First of all, what is your impression of what you have inherited and what you intend to do?
Well, I'm very familiar with the challenges that we face as a network. I've been the chair of the board for the last 2 years and on the board locally for 5 years in Los Angeles. You know, crisis is also opportunity. Challenge is when you make good changes. It's the time to bring us into the present age of what's going on around us, media-wise, technology-wise. It's you can look at it in a good way or a bad way. We face a lot of challenges as a network, but they're not insurmountable in any way.
Have you any impressions of what Pacifica as a network accomplished tonight and tries to do on moments of national significance?
Well, I think we try to give perspective and voice to all of the voices that are shut out of mainstream media. I think that is, you know, our primary mission is to be available as a conduit of information to the public that they don't get anywhere else. And that's what we do here. It's what we do all the time when we're doing what we're supposed to do.
Have you a vision of how the unique federally licensed ability to broadcast unfettered, undigitized, unmonitored in the very precious licenses that the five stations have as broadcast entities. What are the ways in which you think that we can enhance that unique leverage? I mean, there are a million websites, but very few voices.
Yes, well, I mean, we have some of the oldest licenses in the country, so we have tremendous reach. We have the most incredible signals in the largest markets in the country. So clearly, as radio stations, we are uniquely positioned to reach an incredible number of people with what we have to say. In terms of, you know, yes, there are a million websites, but people are getting their media in large measure from the internet. It does not displace broadcast radio at all. They should be working in conjunction. Digital technology, people are on their phones constantly. And you can access radio stations from there. So yes. What I see is, you know, embracing the changes in technology, which enhance what we already do as a broadcast medium, so that we are, you know, we already stream. Yes, we stream on our websites, but we can enhance that tremendously. Social media, all the ways that people are accessing media to bring them to our radio stations.
One of the beauties and also one of the Achilles of Pacifica is its inclusion. And we have seen under the thing which is called democratization within Pacifica, the accumulation of many varied interests. And yet the foundation, the institution, is bound by a charter that requires us to explore the differences among cultures, to understand things in a way that might enhance mutual understanding and set a basis for peace. How do you intend to, if not implement, enhance that process, that commitment of Pacifica, with the growing number of sometimes conflicting interests that you must face?
Well, I'm, you know, strangely, I'm of the opinion that, you know, we have 24 hours in the broadcast day. I never understand the conflict between hearing different opinions, different voices. We should be able to amicably disagree with one another while still being alternative to the mainstream. I think that, you know, to hear that diversity of opinion, we're living in a world in a state of crisis, of financial peril all around the world. That's what we're seeing in social movements. That's, you know, what spawned, you know, from Arab Spring to Occupy Wall Street. These things don't come out of a vacuum. People don't wake up one day and say, gee, I think I should go out in the streets because I want your brand of democracy. They go out in the streets because they can't buy food for their children. They go out in the streets because corporations are manipulating what's going on in the world to such an extent that people are starving absolutely to death. You know, in this country, people are out in the streets because they've followed what they thought they were supposed to do and gone out and gotten a college education, and they cannot find jobs. People are being foreclosed on at record rates. This allows such a broad range of discussion that, frankly, cuts across people's political viewpoints, their philosophical outlook. Economics is a broad determinant that people engage with because it affects their ability to live. And I see that we have room on our airwaves to have all the permutations of discussion, different people's takes on what is going on. And rather than being contentious with one another about, you know, I don't agree with this opinion or I didn't like what that person had to say, we should embrace that. We should embrace radio is good when there is diversity and disagreement. That's what makes it dynamic and interesting. That's what a discussion is. That's what a debate is. And, you know, so I feel there's incredible room to have all of that diversity without in any way compromising what our mission is. That is what the mission is.
Is part of that the envisioning of a production or a tactical superstructure that would enhance the great contributions that each of the five communities and others might be able to bring to an even more prominent regime of national broadcast?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, ideally what I would like to see, and I've certainly stressed this amongst the managers, I want to see us work cohesively as an organization, group unity, a network. We are a network, and we have very little, we have no network branding. Very few people know what Pacifica is, even if they identify with their local station. So I feel there are good programs produced at every one of our local stations, and that, frankly, we should take those programs, and we should identify which ones have broad-based national appeal because they deal with subjects which are of interest to the entire country, and network ties to a certain extent and put those across the network where we are cross-pollinating, where we're sharing the absolute best that we produce in every location.
So we may look forward to the production means of a nationally and internationally expressed stream of new birth.
I would like to see that. Yes, definitely. We have incredible talent. We have incredible talent within the network. There's incredible talent outside of the network that can be brought in. Mm-hmm. And it takes some unity. It takes, you know, everybody seeing a larger vision, not being parochial, not just seeing your own station, but seeing that we are part of a world community and that we serve an incredibly unique place in the entire media environment.
So, Maurice, I would be remiss not to ask the following question.
Sure.
You come upon the executive direction of the institution at a very Lincoln-esque time.
Yes.
At which the continuity of the union is a primary issue. And as a veteran of WBAI, as a senior national correspondent, Polk Award winner, and a co-participant with KPFA and many other stations in various venues, I find there is some consternation over recent loose talk about the possibility of selling the broadcast license of WBAI, which, of course, as you know, is imprecisely stated since the licenses of the stations are owned by the Pacifica Foundation. But in the economic climate of the times, all of the stations, I think, have been under some difficulty. Mm-hmm. WBAI, as I understand it, has made tremendous gains in reducing an inherited debt over recent years and times. Mm-hmm. And yet, there are exigent assertions made that it might be feasible or viable to sell the license, get a few bucks, take a Mickey Mouse frequency, and create some other smaller attempts at broadcast elsewhere, rather than maintaining this precious middle of the commercial band license at WBAI. What is your opinion on this talk about possibly, quote, selling WBAI, quote?
Well, it's never going to happen while I'm in this position, that's for sure. We'll start there. I don't even consider it an option. I think this is background chatter, quite frankly, from people who, whether they have political agendas or they're simply trying to find a solution to, you know, get out of the woods, it isn't an option. This is an incredible signal in the largest market in the country, and I don't even consider that to be something on the table. The bylaws, for one, wouldn't allow a station to simply be sold. It would take a vote of the membership. So it's, some of these things are almost ludicrous in their proposition because they have no reality. But beyond that, you know, I've spoken to my colleagues in the public radio field. It would be an extreme detriment to the station to in any way do a signal swap. There is no way that would be beneficial to WBAI. We have an incredibly strong signal. We're in radio. We are in the largest market in the country. If we need more listeners, that's what we do. We get more listeners. We change up the programming. We do what needs to be done. We cater to the public. We are here to serve the public. That is our mission, is to serve the listening audience. So I consider those things to be completely untenable as any sort of solution in any way. And even beyond that, you know, it's open to question whether one can even sell a public radio license. The FCC gives this to us to use for the public benefit, not necessarily for the aggrandizement of any financial benefit to what anyone thinks that would mean to the rest of the network. It would be just such a diminution to who we are. We are in all of the largest markets, and that's where we're going to stay. So we're going to deal with the problems at WBAI. You know, one of the, you know, we have underlying issues like high fixed costs because we're in Manhattan. So, you know, if somebody out there has an empty radio facility, you know, give me a call. I will come look at it. But those are the things we need to deal with. You know, we need to deal with increasing our listenership, having broader outreach. You know, you don't talk to yourself inside a vacuum if you want to increase your outreach. You let people know you're there, you know, and that's something that hasn't happened effectively in Pacifica. We don't advertise. We don't reach out beyond the audience, which is already listening to us on the airwaves. This is something you do. You go into multimedia platforms. You know, I want to see us, you know, quite frankly, put video cameras in and do live streaming for those programs that want to do it because people like pictures and it doesn't take away from radio. Lots of radio stations do this. You broadcast on radio and you stream it on the web at the same time, and there you are, you know.
So you are not technophobic then?
Not even a little.
I'm
having my national website redesigned as we speak.
I then leave the final word to you of what you imagine Pacifica and its content, its workers, producers, volunteers, and supporters might be engaged in your glorious five-year plan.
I would like to see us work more collaboratively and cohesively. I would like to see more group unity, recognizing that we occupy one of the most valuable institutions in the country, that we have all of the voices that have been important politically have been on our airwaves, that we have an incredible archive of all of the important political history in this country. So I would like to see us move forward. I'd like to see us double our audiences. I want to get this station stabilized. We have to move our Washington, D.C. station, get everyone into facilities they can afford, tune up the programming, fix the morning and evening grids so that they're really dynamic, draw in new audience, get people that have never listened to us before or people who stopped listening a long time ago. We have important things to say, and the public is hungry to hear these things, so we simply need to reach more of them.
Summer Reese, Executive Director of the Pacifica Foundation. It has been even more of an honor than it was a serendipity.
Thank you,
to
Robert.
Have you here tonight.
Likewise. Very much so.
This is WBAI and Pacifica's special coverage of the presidential town hall meeting earlier tonight. We continue. Later on, we'll be speaking with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. And there was a feminist, or was it a democratic, moment just a short time ago, earlier this evening, when the two candidates, presidential and vice presidential, of the Green Party, in the persons of Jill Stein and Sherry Honkala, held a press conference and sought entry to the presidential debate, which under prior terms, with an 85% potential of voter turnout for a given ticket when the debates were run by the League of Women Voters, would have allowed and mandated the Green Party participation in tonight's Republican and Democratic rhetorical monopoly. They held their press conference, Stein and Honkala, and then they besat themselves with flags in their laps in front of Hofstra University on Long Island and were subsequently arrested by local police. Here now, this just in, is what it sounded like.
You got to move back over here. Run over by a car.
Just slide over. Just for a minute while she makes a phone call. We need you to slide over.
Slide over here.
Please.
Just slide over.
Well, we're here to stand our ground. We're here to stand ground for the American people who have been systematically locked out of these debates for decades by the Commission on Presidential Debates. We think that this commission is entirely illegitimate, that if democracy truly prevailed, there would be no such commission, that the debates would still be run by the League of Women Voters, that the debates would be open with the criteria that the League of Women Voters had always used, which was that if you have done the work to get on the ballot, if you are on the ballot and could actually win the Electoral College by being on the ballot in enough states, that you deserve to be in the election and you deserve to be heard, and that the American people actually deserve to hear choices which are not bought and paid for by multinational corporations and Wall Street. This is why we are not hearing the critical issues in this debate. Where are young people in this debate, in this election? You'd think that the younger generation must be public enemy number one for all the bandwidth and all the attention that young people are receiving in this debate. How about those 36 million students and recent graduates who are effectively indentured servants because they are carrying around unforgiving, horrendous debt, specially customized for students so that there's no way you can get out of that debt. It will follow you around. It will garner your wages. Bankruptcy will not protect you. This is special student debt brought to you by a corporate-sponsored Congress. Where is the attention to the plight of these young people carrying that debt, facing a 50% unemployment and underemployment rate, unable to pay back that debt? Where is the issue of skyrocketing costs of public higher education? Where's the solution? The solution, in fact, is that we could be providing free public higher education. We did that after the Second World War in the GI Bill. For every dollar that the taxpayer put into public higher education, $7 was returned to the economy. This is absolutely the right thing to do instead of bailing out the banks. The fourth bailout is going on right now to the tune of $40 billion a month through this QE3, Quantitative Easing 3. We're not going to hear about that in the debate. We're not going to hear about the fact that all the other bailouts so far, $4.5 trillion in money dispersed, $16 trillion in free loans given to the big banks, that in spite of that, the crisis goes on. The banks are still too big to fail, too big to jail. It's time for the American people to hear about the solutions that can really fix this problem and to hear about the candidates that they have a right to vote for. On November 6th, we are here to bring that courage to this blocked debate, this mockery of a democracy that we deserve and only we can take it back and make it democratic once again.
So we're going to go now. And we're going to represent the 85% of the people across this country that agree that we should be in here and be a part of the debates today.
So let's give your names, please.
Give your names.
Jill Stein, Green Party presidential candidate.
Yay, and I'm Jill. Sherry Honkla, the vice presidential Green Party candidate.
Woo!
C-H-E-R-I-H-O-N-K-A-L-A.
Jill Stein, J-I-L-L-S-T-E-I-N.
Okay, on behalf of democracy, we think that democracy starts today with opening up the debates for every single political party in the United States of America to be a part of the debate system, not just corporate America-sponsored debates.
and gentlemen, you are obstructing the vehicle of pedestrians and traffic. If you refuse to move, you are subject to arrest. I am ordering you to immediately leave this roadway, move along the sidewalk. If you do so voluntarily, no charges will be lodged against you. If you do not comply, you will be arrested immediately.
We're just here practicing our First Amendment rights.
To block traffic?
Amendment rights to go in there.
So you're refusing to move?
We in no way want to block any traffic.
So you're refusing to move?
We just want to get into the debate.
But you're blocking traffic, so you refuse to move.
We want to practice our First Amendment rights.
All right,
John. Thank you.
Watch the flag. Who's part of it? Thank you. Come with us. Just come.
You guys have to stay here.
All right, everybody, we're going to ask you to please move.
Stand tall, ladies.
It is nice to block the doorway. It is nice to go to jail. There are nicer ways to do it, but the nice ways always fail. It isn't nice, it isn't nice. You told us once, you told us twice, but if that is freedom's price, we don't mind. It is nice to carry banners or to sit in on the floor, or to shout our cry of freedom at the hotel and the store. It isn't nice, it isn't nice. You told us once, you told us twice, but if that is freedom's price, we don't mind. We have tried negotiation and the three-man picket line. Mr. Charlie didn't see us, and you might as well be blind. Now our new ways are nice when we deal with men of ice, but if that is freedom's price, we don't mind. Now about those years of lynching and the shot in Evers' back, did you say it wasn't proper? Did you stand out on the track? You were quiet just like mice. Now you say we are nice, though if that is freedom's price, we don't mind. It is nice to block the doorway. It is nice to go to jail. There are nicer ways to do it, but the nice ways always fail. It isn't nice, it isn't nice. Well, thanks for your advice. But if that is freedom's price, we don't mind, we don't mind.
This is WBAI Pacifica special coverage of this evening's presidential town hall between the Democrats and the Republicans, represented by Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. The sound of the excluded parties, the Green Party candidates, Jill Stein and Sherry Honkala. The audio of their arrest for sitting down in a not nice way in defense of democracy was courtesy of the Long Island Report. And of course, we heard Malvina Reynolds singing It Isn't Nice. We are now joined with more insight on the so-called debate process in the person of George Farah, a former guest of 5 o'clock Shadow and the executive director of Open Debates, accessible at opendebates.org. And George joins us live from the scene of the crime, where he is, I am told, at the Anheuser-Busch tent. How are the Clydesdales doing tonight, George?
I'm doing great. The beer is flowing. The reporters are getting tipsy. This is quite a scene, I tell you. For the last 8 years, I've been quite a fierce critic of the Commission on Presidential Debates. And one of my pinpoint criticisms has been that it's largely financed by major corporations with regulatory interests before Washington. And Anheuser-Busch has been the principal sponsor of these presidential debates. By and large, these debates are brought to you by Bud Light. And this is my first time actually in one of these tents, and it's quite a scene to see this much Bud Light. It really is paying for these debates and making these reporters quite happy.
Well, so you're saying that we're now in the aftermath of the Anheuser-Busch administration.
Yeah, I have to say, though, you know, I I've been a very strong critic of the way these debates are structured, and the fundamental issue of allowing the candidates to control the process behind closed doors and be held accountable and not be held accountable for that kind of manipulation is antithetical to the functioning of any democracy. That being said, the debate tonight was, in my opinion, quite exciting, in large part because the very contractual provision that Obama and Romney's lawyers had laid out to constrain this town hall debate were cast aside by the moderators, by the candidates, frankly, by everyone. And it brought more direct confrontation between the candidates and some real fireworks.
Do you think that after the odd legal premise of a conspiracy agreement through the Presidential Debate Commission of Mitt Romney and Barack Obama and their representatives, that they sign a contract and then try to enforce their interpretation on it on a reporter, anchor, moderator who was not party to that? Do you think that Candy Crowley womaned up in tonight's event?
Yes, I really do. And, you know, every contract that I've seen, and I obtained copies of 1992 and 1996 from whistleblowers, and 2004 was made public due to the extraordinary pressure in a similar way it was released this year. That is, it was leaked. Someone got a copy of it. It wasn't the commission that made the document public. But in every one of these contracts, the signatories to the document are the Republican and Democratic campaigns and their lawyers. No reporter has ever signed these documents, but in the past, they have complied with many of the rules because, look, these guys want to moderate more debates. It's a pinnacle of their career. It's a great privilege to be moderating the most important election events. And the last thing they want to do is infuriate the parties or the commission and risk no longer being picked to be a moderator. But we're seeing an exciting trend. Candy Crowley really had tremendous guts today because regardless of whether or not you think she did a good job, and I know there's different varying opinions on that, she definitely stomped on the rules and stipulations that the candidates' campaigns had negotiated, which had prohibited her from asking any follow-up questions, which had prohibited her from asking any questions seeking clarification, in essence reducing her to just a lady with a microphone that keeps time. So I applaud the decisions and the steps that she took to ignore that document and hope that this sets a precedent of ignoring the instructions of the candidates.
In a wider sense, tonight we saw a debate, words were said, but in a very large way, it was a drama. It was an exercise in demeanor, poise, and acting. And the format was invented by many people before this day. Phil Donahue, Joe Pine, and many other great legends of television and radio. So as an ultimate question or a penultimate question for you, how can the American public, in your opinion, be better served in terms of knowledge of the issues and the consequences thereof beyond the drama of personal individuals with a deeper analysis of their backers, their institutions, their parties, and their goals? What is a better way of interrogating the reality of the rhetoric of presidential campaigns?
That's a fascinating question. Absolutely fascinating question. Part of the reason that I started this organization and wrote a book on the presidential debate process was precisely because I believe in their potential. You know, in my opinion, the debates are, well, first, it's a factual reality to some extent that they're the most important election events on a consistent basis. But that aside, they can function in our democracy when done right as an antidote to money. You know, we're in a post-Citizens United Supreme Court world where super PACs can finance campaigns. We're coming closer to countries like Russia where billionaires can essentially sponsor candidates. And nothing is more important than this flood of money than having a unique opportunity to see the candidates actually having a discussion, ideally thoughtfully, ideally unpredictably, and ideally not in the dramatic sense that you described. That's very hard to do because as candidates like Herman Cain took skyrocket based exclusively on their debate performances, not on their financial war chests, not on political consultant design 30-second television commercials, but on their debate performances. So my opinion is if we had more debates at the general election level, debates that were not choreographed in advance with restrictive rules, debates that included, if there are any, viable popular third-party voices, and there were, instead of three, eight of them, and had formats that were designed to get the candidates off their script, our democracy would be very much better, sir.
Well, George Farah, thank you for joining us tonight. How can people find out about your work with open debates and perhaps retrieve the rhetoric into a more sensible and informative form?
Please visit our website, opensdebates.org. You can also follow me at Twitter at Farah Findings. And this is a movement. This is a grassroots movement. The more supporters that we have to demand that the candidates participate in real debates, the greater likelihood we have of breaking the monopoly of the commission itself. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, George Farah. We will talk again before the next debate, as these things are called. This is Pacifica Radio, originating at WBAI in New York. My name is Robert Knight. I'm the host of 5 O'Clock Shadow. And we are now joined by Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. And Medea, welcome to tonight's program. Earlier on, we had the audio of the arrest of two women from the Green Party, the presidential and vice presidential contenders, Jill Stein and Sherry Honkala, who attempted to assert their third-party rights, as it's called, to be at tonight's beauty pageant at Hofstra on Long Island. They were arrested. We are trying to monitor the status of their condition and confinement, but what do you make of that development?
I think it's great that they put themselves out there and to highlight this issue that George is talking about how narrow these debates are, and it's terrible that people have to go to this kind of extreme, but that's the way things are in this election season, where we only hear this very narrow view between two men, and seeing these two women sitting down and holding an impromptu press conference where they talked about why they thought it was so critical to get third-party voices in the debate, I think is something we should really applaud.
Medea Benjamin, throughout your work with Code Pink and many other institutions in the progressive spirit around the world and in the United States, and we will speak soon about some of your world travels, what is your first impression about the debate at which you were at a viewing or listening party?
Well, I think the narrowness of the discussion, not having third-party views, you don't get to hear anything about a different idea about health care, such as single payer. You don't get a different idea as to the free trade versus fair trade. I mean, both of them are very free trade. You don't get a different idea as to issues around foreign policy. So I think the people, at least that I was watching the debates with, our biggest issue is that the spectrum is so narrow.
Well, one of the things that comes to obvious consideration about tonight is that it's been a very long time since there has been a female moderator of a presidential debate. And the question of feminism comes to mind, and one wonders whether the prominence tonight is counter-indicative of the general dismissiveness of women's issues in the media, the confinement to a narrow presumed interests of the so-called swing feminine vote in the United States, and whether or not there is pandering to that. Do you think that the full spectrum of feminist issues was adequately addressed?
No, I think there is. There was a good question about women's issues, and I think Obama came out much better than Mitt Romney in terms of supporting women's access to contraception, supporting Planned Parenthood, and supporting women's rights in general. But again, the discussion is narrow. There's no discussion of what a third-party candidate like Jill Stein probably would have brought up, like the need to pass the Equal Rights Amendment or the need to pass the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, also known as CEDA, the U.S. being one of the few countries in the world and the only industrialized nation that haven't passed it, the fact that there are still only 15% of people in Congress are women, and certainly even in more issues about women's reproductive rights and economic equality and violence against women, no discussion about the huge number of women who are subjected to domestic violence, rape, even within the military. So I think there should have been a lot more discussion about women's issues.
We're speaking with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. And Medea, your work has involved not only the status and ever-sought equality of women, but also peace and justice for people of many different hues and genders around the world. And I'm very taken that since our last conversation on 5 o'clock shadow, you were engaged in a very significant trip and protest on behalf of humanitarian interests in Pakistan and elsewhere with a number of ethical colleagues. Can you tell us where you went and what you did?
Yes, and let me just relate it to these debates, Robert, because I don't think that Mitt Romney would be any better than Barack Obama when it comes to foreign policy. It would probably be worse. But the fact that in these debates, this incredible program of drone strikes doesn't even come up is very disconcerting. And we felt, as Code Pink that put together this delegation to Pakistan, that it was important to try to bring more media attention to this issue. And one way to do that was going directly to Pakistan, a place where U.S. drone strikes have killed over 3,000 people, with very little, almost no discussion of this in the United States, and certainly not as part of the election discussions. So we took a group of 34 people at great risk to everybody's life to try to go into Waziristan, the area that has been subjected to so many of these drone strikes, and meet directly with the drone victims. So it was the first time that Americans were even going into this tribal area in the last decade, and a great success in the sense that we got to tell a lot of people of Pakistan and got tremendous media coverage inside Pakistan that there were Americans who were adamantly opposed to the Obama administration policy of such indiscriminate killing of so many innocent people with their drone strikes.
I understand that during part of that process, you and the group might have gotten barricaded or containered in part of the protest. Just for technical curiosity for those who've been following you, what happened there?
The government of Pakistan decided that it was too unsafe to let the march proceed into the heart of Waziristan, and so set up these huge containers to barricade the road. So we were not able to go to the town of Katkai, which is where the rally had been planned, and instead the rally took place at the border entry into Waziristan, a place called Tank.
Those are the same kind of containers that were used to suffocate dissidents by General Dostum in Afghanistan in previous times. So I'm very happy to learn that you suffered no such consequences, even though the government of Pakistan is in a precarious position between the interest of the ISI, the Taliban, the tribal regions, and autonomy. And the ever-present American drones, about which you've written in your book, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. So this must have been a very complex diplomatic and political endeavor for you.
It was, in the sense that we spent the week meeting with different political parties. We met with human rights groups, women's organizations, drone victims. There were about a dozen victims that came to Islamabad before the march began to meet with us and tell us their stories. And Robert, we did have occasion to meet twice with the acting ambassador, Richard Hoagland, which was quite interesting. And we were surprised that he was willing to meet with us and talk about this, the drone strikes, given that it is a covert program and it's been very hard to get American officials to talk about this. So we felt that that was a success in that we got to bring our viewpoints both before and after the march and press the embassy to take this issue more seriously, to really look into the allegations of civilian casualties, the issue of drone strikes that kill rescuers, which is something that is obviously against international law and constitutes war crimes. We gave the ambassador individual names and cases that we wanted him to look into and get back to us on, and we will certainly follow up with those.
Badia Benjamin of Code Pink We thank you for your insight today and note with great pride and significance your authorship of a book called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, with a foreword by Barbara Ehrenreich. And for our Pacifica and WBAI audience, I am proudly required to note that we are in our fundraising period, and you have very generously made available a limited number of copies of this book for people of astute wisdom to learn about what is going to be, continue to be, the issue of tomorrow. Medea, even as we speak, there are reports seeping out that the Obama administration is diverting funds and prepping various military contingencies, including what is now increasingly spoken of as a potential drone strike on who knows where and what and who inside Libya, as a result of the security malfunction that resulted in the death of the ambassador J. Christopher Stevens and three other American security and information personnel. Now, drone warfare is taking place potentially, well, certainly surveillance already is, but I mean missile and weapon strikes in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Somalia, and other places in the world, Iraq, possibly Iran, and throughout the crown of Northern Africa, the Arabian Peninsula. Can you tell people why this book is important and what they might learn in order to better fight death and surveillance from above?
Unfortunately, Robert, this is the wave of the future if we don't get involved and try to stop it, because it is, Leon Panetta, Secretary of Defense, said, the only game in town. All the weapons manufacturers in the United States have gotten involved in this drone business, and they have strong lobbyists, and these lobbyists have their friends in Congress who are pushing to lift any restrictions on selling drones overseas, lift restrictions on the use of drones here in the United States, and they're doing a good job of it. There are now 76 countries around the world that have drones, and then there are non-state actors like Hezbollah that just flew drones into Israeli airspace that have drones as well. The U.S. is setting a precedent that we can go anywhere in the world, kill anyone we want on the basis of secret information, and what does this say for the rest of the world? So this book is very important for people to get an understanding of where drones are being used, how they're being used, who is manufacturing them, what does this mean for international law, what does it mean for ethics and morality, and the last two chapters are devoted to what can people do about it.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Medea. I consider this one of the keystone books of the next decade. And just as we needed to have an early warning on Agent Orange during the Vietnam War, as we needed to have an early warning on the drugs during the Contra Wars, this is a book of the future. I thank you for writing it, for sharing it with us for the benefit of the station and the enlightenment of our listeners. And I thank you for the flavor, and I will spare you the sausage making of the fundraising, but I give you the last word here now.
Wonderful. Well, I think the debates highlight the need for alternative viewpoints, and were it not for these Pacifica stations and BAI, we would indeed not even have the educated progressive movement that we have that's pushing for things like third-party candidates to be in the debates and a broader spectrum of views being put out to the public. So thank you for your work and for the radio station.
Where can people follow you, Medea?
At codepink.org. We also have a new website called droneswatch.org where we're putting a lot of this information up and encourage your listeners to check out those websites as well as our Twitter and Facebook.
Thank you. Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is Pacifica WBAI coverage of the presidential town hall meeting. Thank you, Summer Reese.
Thank you, Robert.
For being with us tonight. Thanks also to George Farah of Open Debates, Max Schmid for engineering, and of course, Medea Benjamin for supporting us. I'm Robert Knight of 5 o'clock Shadow, and here's our summary of tonight's debate.
Johnny, I said we were through just to see what you were. dance with me. You let Freddy cut in constantly. When he does, you never speak. Or must you always be so meek? Oh, Johnny, get angry. Johnny, get mad. Give me the biggest lecture I ever had. That you care, really care for me. Someone who she can always look up to. You know I love you, of course. Let me know that you're the boss. Oh, Johnny, get angry. Johnny, get mad. Give me the biggest lecture I ever had. I want a brave man. I want a caveman. Johnny, show me that you care, really care for me. Johnny,